Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, the 9th of August, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is David Peters, and he will be speaking on why capital punishment should be abandoned. So let's listen in on David.
After the multiple murders and cannibalism which were involved in his serial killings, Wisconsin sort of awoke from its slumbers. It remains one of 14 states in the Union that do not have capital punishment. 36 do. The lion's share of states have capital punishment. We and our sister state, Minnesota, are among the 14 that don't. And a whole spate of bills began entering the Wisconsin Assembly and Senate, which, if they were passed, would institute capital punishment in Wisconsin. This is a rather incendiary issue in Wisconsin. For those of you who come from states that have capital punishment, perhaps it is a settled issue. This is one of the reasons as to why I have become interested in this particular issue, because my state is torn up by it. The advertisement for this particular session was the declaration of a statement why capital punishment should be abandoned. That was rather risky to frame the subject of this session by declaring that I'm going to defend a thesis. Some people told me after the session on Monday that they appreciated the fact that our discussion of euthanasia and so forth, the facilitator here, namely me, did not plump for some particular decision, sort of walk both sides of the street like you do in law school. But I thought, well, maybe I should frame the issue that way, why capital punishment should be abandoned, on the wager that since 36 states have gotten capital punishment, let us assume that most of the citizenry endorse capital punishment, so I would at least would have the advantage of talking against a party line view, and you might be interested in hearing a non-party line view. So we have something to debate. I want to just ask this lead question now. How many of you here right now, not that you've made up your mind about this issue, but I'll put it this way. How many of you now are inclined to endorse capital punishment for first-degree murder? Just a show of hands. Three. How many of you are disinclined at this moment to endorse it? Because there's a third alternative, namely you have both feet firmly planted midair. How many of you are inclined, at least at this particular juncture, to be against capital punishment? To be against it? I'm taking a poll as to how I'm trying to get a Quaker sense of the meeting here. Concerning
I'm
comedy.
Against it.
You're against it?
Yes.
Okay. And how many of you are waffling on this? Don't know. But you held up your hand before.
I know I did.
But you didn't
have to waffle.
Yeah, but the law of excluded middle, so you can't. I mean, you either stand for I don't know.
No,
or
you said right. Inclined.
Inclined.
Inclined, yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Inclined.
With his feet up in the air.
Okay, let's do it again. Let's be bipolar. Okay.
Oh,
yes. You only have two choices this time around. I want to find out how many of you at this moment, if you had a vote now, before thinking further and further reflection on it, would be inclined to vote yes, my state should have capital punishment for first degree murder. I mean, how many would be inclined that way? Okay, three. And then the rest of you are against it.
Not necessarily.
have to ask for people to
can't waffle.
That's not fair to say. It's three against everybody.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what is going to be most useful. Okay? If the majority of people in here really subscribe to the thesis that I was going to defend initially, namely that we should abandon it, then I'm the federal Trade Commission would be after me. I'm going to change the title. Why we should have capital punishment.
Then that's all the against. Let's see what he does.
He's the walker. Very good.
Well, I mean, in a way, if I proceeded on plan A, which was to go with the title, I might be preaching to the choir. I mean, I might be preaching to the already converted. Shall we go the other way?
I
want
to know why.
Huh?
I want to know why.
Why capital punishment should be abandoned?
I mean, I know why I think so. I want to know why you think it should be abandoned. Do you have any arguments? Do you have any scripture? Do you have any, why?
Okay, let's start at the biblical. What is the biblical?
Well, wait a minute. If I can just hold this off here. What you have to recognize, I mean, what I take us to be doing is to dealing with a public policy issue. Now, here's just one of the ground rules of public policy discussion as they go on in state assemblies, in the federal legislature. We not only have an official separation of church and state, but the kinds of arguments which are adduced in favor of passing certain bills. To my knowledge, I don't know of too many people that get up and trot out distinctly religious arguments for it. The arguments for or against public policies typically attempt to draw on a shared set of common moral commitments which are neutral to the fact as to whether you're an atheist, an agnostic, a Catholic, or Lutheran. I mean, this is the way public debates go. Somebody, if they got up in the Minnesota assembly and was speaking against the passage of a living will law, which would allow people to say, I don't want X, Y, and Z kinds of things, if I get in dire straits. If somebody got up there and said, listen, we should not vote for this particular bill because, after all, God is the giver of life and only God has the right to take life. And therefore, if you take your own life or something, you usurp some right from God. I think most people would stand there bewildered because this simply sort of digs the hole deeper. Because for those out there that think that the God hypothesis itself is very controversial, now it pushes the discussion up into philosophical discussion of whether God exists because you're trying to hang it on a distinctly religious premise. So there's sort of understood ground rules in public policy debate that what we're going to draw on is sort of some common base of ethical commitments, the lowest common denominator, shared commitments, obviously we all have different directions. There are indeed, I think, some interesting biblical resources for us, but maybe the first calling is to try and do a mock run-through of the sorts of arguments that might be trotted out in a public forum, for or against, capital punishment, just to see the way the game is played without distinctly religious commitments. And then we can come back and ask the issue, as Christians, I mean, are there certain, biblical resources that we can use to guide us? So I would just like to, have us mimic a public policy debate as it would typically be carried out either if you go as a citizen to make public testimony in front of legislatures that are seeking information, voting on a bill, or that you might argue on the floor of a state assembly. So we're still back to the issue of what kind of case would be most productive to give. I mean, the case for it, or the case against it.
So you're talking about issues like deterrent factors.
Exactly.
And issues maybe going so far as some ethical issues, as long as you don't step over some unknown boundary out there, like the ethical nature of the state being the one to put somebody to death, and what that might mean ethically. Would you get into something like that?
Yeah, I think you're going to have to. Yeah. I think you're going to have to. But it's not necessary to have distinctly evangelical Lutheran church commitments to discuss this, or Catholic commitments. I mean, it can be discussed, I think, on a certain kind of common ground, which is implicitly there.
One more question with regard to the ground rules. You said to appeal to commonly shared premises.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be true to say that not everyone may share a common premise here, even non-religious, let's say philosophical, but they could. If they were simply instructed in right reason. I'm looking. You understand what I'm saying? The Catholics are very good at this. I mean, if you're a Thomist, then grace complements reason. But the problem is that not everybody has good reason, so we'll instruct you first in reason, and then maybe we can proceed on to theology.
So, like the ancient Stoics, the first part that we have to do is you have to have a course in logic.
Yeah.
All right. So that you know whether you know good inferences from bad inferences, and then we can go on to physics, and maybe we can get to the yoke, you know, which is ethics or something.
And then we'll be out of time.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you coming. Okay. Let's try it this way. I'll just change the name of the game. I'm going to defend. I'm going to give you a laced together. One argument does not a case make. Okay. So I'm going to try and give you a case which is made up of multiplicity of arguments, designed to convince reasonable people that capital punishment is the right way to go with respect to first-degree murder. Okay. Now, I think my hope is that it will alienate most of you, since you seem to indicate that you're in favor of disbanding it, but then we can talk about what can be said on the other side. Okay? Most of you already recognize that there really are two major theoretical approaches to justifying capital punishment. You know them by name. One is the famous deterrence theory, and the other is called the retribution theory. I mean, I'm just reminding you of what you already know. In short form, the deterrence theory, it really comes in two varieties. The first variety of the deterrence theory says we ought to have capital punishment lying in wait for first-degree murders because when we execute a convicted felon, we send a message. Sounds like George Wallace of yesterday. We send a message to those people out there that are percolating the idea of bumping off Uncle Charlie or somebody, sending them a message that if you follow through this and you get caught, this is what's going to happen to you. And the argument here, it's going to dissuade people who have not yet done an act from following through on it. It's going to have a fear potential. It's going to head off at the pass the loss of innocent life. There's a second variety to the deterrence argument. I think it's inappropriately called the deterrence argument. This is frequently given by prison wardens and so forth. And it runs this way. If you execute a convicted felon, he ain't going to do any more murders. Because dead men don't murder again. They don't carve up guards. They don't carve up wardens. They don't shoot fellow inmates. Right? So in that sense, we deter murder by exterminating the life of the murderer. He doesn't commit anymore. So this is argued as sort of deterrence sub two. Okay? I think it probably deserves the title of prevention rather than deterrence. Then you got the retribution rationale. And this simply says, the reason we ought to punish a felon who's committed a murder is because he deserves it. QED, end of case. I mean, it's an entirely backward-looking approach, which says, look at this horrendous deed which has been done. Like the blood on the ground cries out that something must be done in response. A human life, an egregious action has been done, and we must deal with it. Now, just to take an all-seeing angel's view of this terrain, the deterrence argument is typically futuristically looking. It's looking out in the future because it's trying to diminish the amount of the loss of life of victims whose lives are not yet claimed, right? Whereas the retribution argument is a backward-looking argument. It doesn't care a whit about whether capital punishment deters. It simply says, if we don't deal with this criminal offender, something's just wrong. I mean, it's just out of kilter. So retributionists typically don't give a hoot about deterrence. They simply said there's a morally horrible deed that's been done, and we must respond to it.
That's an equalizing, balancing kind of.
Okay, well, let me lace together a couple of arguments, forms of argument, from the retribution rationale and the deterrence rationale. You might as well draw on both camps if you can finally sustain the bottom line that we ought to institute capital punishment, like Wisconsin, or keep it if we already have it. Let's just start with the retribution rationale. The short form of it is that criminals ought to be punished because they deserve it. Let me give you the long form of this particular argument. The first premise of the argument is that crimes should be punished. The second premise in this argument is that the gravity of the punishment should be proportional to the gravity of the crime. I mean, in some sense, the punishment should be equal to the crime or fit the crime. The greater the crime, the greater the punishment, the lesser the crime, the lesser the punishment. You would offend this principle of ratio and proportionality, for example, if you had a penalty of 45 years in prison for shoplifting toothpaste from a 7-Eleven store, or if you had a $5 fine for rape. I mean, it would just be wacko with respect to what is required by the proportionality principle. Third premise in the retribution argument claims that murder is the greatest crime. Then you could deduce that by the proportionality principle that the fitting punishment for murder should be the greatest we have to offer. And then the claim is then enunciated that the greatest punishment we have to offer is death. And that is why death is the appropriate fitting punishment for first degree murder. Now let me tell you why. I mean, you can attack this argument in many different ways, but let me Teflon a particular kind of attack you may want to voice at the outset, simply saying, hold it, I don't like this premise where the greatest punishment or that the appropriate punishment for murder is death, or that our greatest punishment is death. The retribution is going to say, let me tell you why there's a unique proportionality between a murder that's committed and the death penalty. Because what happens with a murder is that that person has extinguished another person's life, has taken away everything that person has. Everything. Therefore, on the proportionality and ratio principle, the punishment must likewise take away everything that a criminal has. And the taking away of everything is fulfilled uniquely by death. And that is why we demand death. Life imprisonment still gives life. You may have taken away freedom of movement, freedom to vote, but you still have something, whereas you're out of kilter with respect to the gravity of the crime, because it took away everything. Now, you may not like... let me first give you that as an argument. Now, as a retributionist, as someone committed to retribution, I've heard most of the standard arguments against the retribution theory. And let me tell you why they're junk. I mean, I'll just give you a sampling as arguments that just don't work, okay? Somebody might come up and tell me, look, if you've got capital punishment, what you're doing to the criminal offender is you are violating an absolute unconditional right to life, which is owned by everyone. And that's why you're in trouble, because when the state executes a person, they violate an absolute sacred, indefeasible right to life owned by everyone. Well, that's balderdash. Why? Well, look, there's a whole variety of killings which we already morally endorse. Killing in self-defense, arguably killing in war. So what are we supposed to do? I mean, if somebody's coming at me with a knife or something and threatens my family, says, well, I'm sorry, I can't even defend myself by taking your life. It's the only thing open to me because, after all, you have an absolutely sacred right to life. I mean, nobody really believes this. Can you imagine John Gacy, who murdered multiple kids, carved them up in pieces and put them under his porch, standing in front of the jury, or standing in front of the sentencing authority, and somebody say, don't you dare sentence me to the electric chair, because I want you people to know that if you do so, you will be violating a sacred, unconditional right to life that I own. Now, what I'm insisting is that even if you heard it from Gacy, you wouldn't accept it, because the right to life is something reciprocal. I mean, you own it so long as you respect it in others. And I'm saying that Gacy can't even make the case, much less anyone making on behalf of Gacy. So I just don't think this objection works. Then we've got the famous objection, the capital punishment is nothing but legalized murder. Now, the whole argument here is that the problem here is the law books. They're trapped in an inconsistency. At one and the same time, they say, look, it's wrong for you and me to bump off somebody else, but it's okay for the state to bump off somebody. Now, I submit that if it's wrong in one circumstance, it must be wrong in the other. So, I mean, if the state is executing people, it's simply doing over a deed which they're condemning for individuals, and are simply in inconsistency here. I mean, capital punishment is nothing but legalized murder. My answer to that, the reason that's not a good argument, is because it begs the question. And what I mean by that, it assumes what needs to be proved. What? What do you mean by murder? I thought that what I mean by murder, and most of us mean by murder, is unjustified killing. Morally unjustified killing. I mean, isn't that what we mean by murder? Now, if somebody comes along and says capital punishment is nothing but legalized murder, it strikes me that they're assuming what I thought was the matter of debate as to whether it is an unjustified killing. I mean, I thought that's what the debate was about, as to whether if the state executes a person, it is morally unjustified. I mean, I thought that's what we were debating. And somebody comes along and somebody says, oh, it's nothing but legalized murder. They're assuming what needs to be proved, and what needs to be proved is that it is morally unjustified. So this argument isn't going to work, because it, in effect, begs the question. Then you got the famous argument, listen, you ought not to get into capital punishment because, once in a while, I mean, juries aren't God, and because of things like evidence withheld at trial or something, I mean, innocent people can be convicted. The jury does the best it can, given the evidence present, presented, but innocent. Somebody might be convicted who really is innocent. And then when you send them to the chair, they're done with. And then maybe a year later or something, new evidence comes up that really shows the person's was innocent. I mean, it's the standard objection. So now you can't do anything. You can't give the person's life back. You have an irreparable harm. Now, you simply you place yourself at risk of generating these irreparable harms when you set yourself up by saying that capital punishment is a punishment that this state will mete out for first-degree murder. Yeah, I mean, you set yourself up for the possibility of executing a person that is really innocent. Whereas if you only had life imprisonment, you see, if evidence turned up after trial which exonerated the person, then while you can't give the years back that they had in prison, you can make some compensation, a form of money, but you can't give any compensation to a dead, innocent person. Okay? I've heard this argument as a retributionist. It doesn't cut any ice. I'll tell you why. It doesn't show that capital punishment is wrong. What it focuses on is the litigation. I mean, the problems that come up with evidence presentation in trials, which may lead to the unwitting convictions of innocent people. It's by the board. It doesn't show that capital punishment is wrong. It shows we've got to clean up our act litigationally. That's all it shows. Then you've got the famous argument that capital punishment is meted out in an unjust manner. That is, that in effect, in this country, it's an exercise in social injustice. Who are the people that are on death row? Well, most of them are blacks. Most of them are impoverished. They're represented by rotten attorneys. They haven't got the kind of money that O.J. And the Mendez boys have got. Since capital punishment is had by 36 states, if you ask who are the states that are really trucking with capital punishment, there's most of the states in the old Confederacy. I mean, it's southern states. And right there, the statistics are overwhelming. That if a jury or a sentencing authority has a discretion as to either give life imprisonment or the death penalty, if you're a black that's murdered a white, we can just about predict the way it's going to go. So here's an objection. Again, I don't think that that objection speaks to the issue. It doesn't show that capital punishment is not the fitting punishment. It just says it shows that we're going to have to do a better job in trying to mute and head off at the pass the kind of prejudice which infects convictions and sentencing. I mean, maybe we'll have to have biracial juries or, it doesn't show that capital punishment ought to be eliminated. Again, it's the problem with the litigation. Now, let me add to this. Yet another reason as to why we should institute capital punishment. Next to my retribution argument, a deterrence argument. Now, I want you to understand that I'm a new breed deterrence thinker, okay? I'm the new improved variety. I don't stand for a certain propositions voiced by Neanderthal deterrence, okay? But let me tell you the deck I'm dealing from. I'm a deterrence theorist, and I'm fully mindful of the fact that the lion's share of murders that are committed in this country are crimes of passion. 80% of them are committed in acts of rage, jealousy, drug highs, inebriation. I concede that. I also concede that when people are in these kind of states, they're not thinking about the electric chair. So, you know, the electric chair doesn't deter these kind of people. But that leaves me 20%. Okay? 20% of murders are at least calculated. Thought about somewhat in advance, maybe not months in advance, where some mafioso was going to roll on Antonio, you know, plot this thing like you have in The Godfather. But, I mean, you got 20% that are not crimes of passion. So as a deterrence theorist, I'm interested in the question as to whether if a state went on record as simply saying, if you follow through on this and you murder somebody and you get caught and you're convicted, you're looking at the gas chamber or the electric chair, I'm placing a wager that that is going to have a deterrent effect among those that can be deterred. The 80% I don't care about anymore. Probably can't do anything about it. But I'm concerned about the 20% because for every deterred murderer, that's an innocent life saved. And that's important to me. I'm also a new improved deterrence theorist because I'm willing to concede to you the most damning fact that all the professional studies that have been done on deterrence show, if the question is put, does capital punishment, does the threat of capital punishment deter more efficiently than the threat of life imprisonment? I recognize that all the studies that have been done collectively are inconclusive. That's just the truth. It's inconclusive. I mean, the professional studies have been done. We just don't know on their basis as to whether capital punishment is a more effective deterrent than life in prison. I concede that. But look, don't make the fallacy, don't appeal to the fallacy of ignorance. God, no. I mean, I don't want somebody to simply say, listen, capital punishment has never been proved to be a more efficient than deterrent of life in prison, therefore it isn't. I can turn the argument right around, simply say, well, capital punishment has never been proved to be less efficient, therefore it is. I mean, this argument from ignorance doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it's an utter, utter fallacy. So I'm conceding the damning fact that the professional studies have been done, that we got both feet firmly planted in the air. We don't know. But I'm telling you, I find it incredible to believe, as a deterrence theorist, that nobody has ever been scared off from a crime by the threat of capital punishment. I find that bonkers. Nobody? And there's an oddity about how in the deuce you get evidence as to whether capital punishment does have a deterrent effect. How do you get evidence? I mean, what would the evidence, I mean, think about what this would be. How do you get evidence? I mean, what do you have, a Yankovic survey? And, you know, I come up to Derek and say, did you ever think about bumping off somebody and back down? Because, oh, he's... You know, I mean, are people going to tell you the truth?
Yeah.
I mean, but what kind of evidence would you get? You'd have to come around with a microphone and depend on, but nobody's going to tell you the truth. And, of course, if somebody doesn't follow through with a murder, non-events don't make it on the police blotter, right? So we got a problem of evidence here. I just find it incredible to believe that no one has ever been frightened away from following through with a dastardly deed on the ground of fear of capital punishment. I just find it incredible. And let me give you another reason. Here I'm arguing from plausibility. I'm conceding that the professional studies give us no hard evidence as to whether capital punishment is a uniquely more effective deterrent than life is life in prison. I'm conceding that. But I have a fallback argument. I'm arguing from plausibility now. I think it's plausible to believe that capital punishment does have a greater deterrent effect than life imprisonment. And let me do it in two steps. First of all, I'm going to appeal to a general rule, which I think is exemplified in your own life, that when you're faced with certain actions with possible high-risk consequences, that genuinely you think twice and thrice before you go through with these actions. I think that this exhibits us all. I remember when I was, not too many years ago, after my dad died, my folks had a cabin up in northern Michigan, which had never been finished off inside, and my mother said, gee, you know, you and Nancy and the kids, why don't you just finish that off so you could go up there during the summer? So I went up there one summer all alone, got wallboard and all this kind of stuff. And I remember, I'm sort of out in the outback and everything, and I'm sitting there with a bench saw trying to slice a 4x8 sheet of plywood. And of course, when you're alone, you're trying to figure out different ways of solving this problem, because you know the board is going to go down, you know, and it's going to bind in the saw, and so I got saw horses out there, you know, to move it through. Well, it got down about the last 6 inches, and this board starts going up and down, and I'm trying to hold it down like this, and the board just drags my thumb right into the saw blade. I'm all alone, so I got to run in the cabin. I get a towel and wrap it around my thumb and drive one-handedly down to Traverse City, which is like 30 miles away, and present myself in the emergency room and so forth. Why am I telling you this story? I'm telling you, I'm never going to do it again. Risks like that, I am not prepared to run. But it's simply an illustration of the general case that the greater the risk, the more cautionary we become. I think it's plausible to believe. It's plausible to believe that death is a more feared penalty than life imprisonment. And the more fearful a penalty is, the more likely the deterrence effect it's going to have. In fact, there's some anecdotal evidence that I can give you from prison chaplains and wardens who report going to prisoners who are under death sentences and reporting to them that the governor or something has commuted their sentence down to life imprisonment, and they simply go, oh, God, as if this tremendous weight has been lifted from their shoulders. I submit this shows that they fear capital punishment more than they do life imprisonment. Let's see if I have any other arguments here. Let me just stop there for a minute. You've heard a case for capital punishment. Responses. Most of you are against it. Where do any of these arguments go awry?
I think the last one is still very convincing to me.
Not convincing.
The deterrence, that there's a deterrence. And I think there's more hard evidence against the argument that you presented. For example, there are a couple of countries that abolished capital punishment, France, England. If there would be really a drop in deterrence after abolishing capital punishment, there should be some kind of response to criminal activity that did not take place.
That should go up.
Yes. So the abolishment of capital punishment did not brought a decline in deterrence that it would be a measurable increase in crime, which shows that that now that capital punishment was abolished, a lot of people felt free to kill other people because they didn't have to fear capital punishment anymore. So I think that's stronger evidence than you presented against the argument of deterrence.
Well, it's a very interesting comeback, because even if it's possible to concede that there's good reason to believe that capital punishment is more feared than life in prison, we need some intervening steps in order to certify the following claim, that ergo, capital punishment is going to be a more effective deterrent than life in prison. I mean, it simply because it's more feared, while it seems plausible on one side to believe that, well, the more feared will have more deterrent effect than, let's say, life imprisonment, there's some unknown factors here, namely that I just don't think we've ever had a true experiment to determine whether life imprisonment really would deter those who can be deterred as much as capital punishment. Because most life imprisonment sentences are usually subject to probation, see? And so the criminal knows that we don't really mean what we said. But suppose we made life imprisonment mandatory, non-negotiable, and we throw away the key. Now, that experiment really hadn't been tried to determine as to whether there would be equal deterrent effect with capital punishment.
The state of Washington is experimenting with that right now with 3 strikes, you're out. And if you are charged with 3 federal crimes, then your sentence is mandatory life imprisonment without parole, period. And that deterrent
thus far, in the few studies that they have made, has made a difference. And it is making a difference.
Or have the incipient beginnings of a study. Do you think that let's talk about this alternative. Life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. You see any consequences of buying into this alternative? Now, we're going to mean what we said. You're in for life. No Zippo possibility of parole. Where are we going with this now?
Does this mean that later on down the road we find out they weren't guilty of such and such?
Yeah, we can release them. That's fine. I mean, that's a gain, right? That's a plus. You're worried about cost.
Well, that's your consequence.
Anybody know what the average cost in a medium security prison for one prisoner is? Anybody have a clue? I have Wisconsin figures.
It's probably as much as a hospital stay.
No.
Not quite that much.
I've heard a couple different. One at about 34, which I thought was real low, and another at about 55,000
per year.
Yeah, in my state, it's about 35 grand a year to house and feed three squares a day in a medium security prison. Okay, so one of the consequences here come the utilitarians, right? One of the consequences of doing justice, locking him up and throwing away the key. We want to be just, right? Because we think, my gosh, this is a serious crime. I mean, you can't have life imprisonment, but with a possibility of parole in 18 months. I mean, it's a laugh, isn't it? I mean, we're going to mean what we're going to say. We're going to be just. It's got to be throw away the key. Well, now here comes the cost. Do you really want to absorb the cost of this?
From what I've read, it's more expensive. I'm up here, I'm sorry.
In the dark.
It's God speaking.
Well, I hate to fill that role. But from what I read, it's more expensive to do the capital punishment than it is to do the life imprisonment.
Why is this? Because let me tantalize you with the argument, and then you can respond. Okay? Here's a very intuitively plausible argument. These kind of arguments you get in what I call the little zip telescoped arguments that you get in letters to the editor, you know, nine lines in the Time magazine. We ought to institute capital punishment because when the guy's dead, we don't have to feed and house him and pay for his medical care. So in the name of economic sanity, we should, I mean, it's cost efficient to simply fry him. Now, I mean, it sounds okay, but wherein lies the fallacy here?
Well, what I just said in my reading, it doesn't pan, that it's more cost effective if we're going to put a dollar figure on someone's life, which I find sort of a horrendous argument in the first place, that it's more cost efficient to house them over a number of years than it is.
Where is the missing variable here that is plugged out of all this, that we're not taking the cognizant?
It's a cost of litigation.
The cost of litigation. Let me read you some. I mean, this is.
But before you go into that, and your comeback would be, therefore, we got to clean up the litigation, we got to speed the process up, we got to fry them quicker, couldn't you make a case that until you clean it up, before it's more racially just, let's just keep them locked up? Because until we have a fair process, we should have no death penalty.
This is a very interesting issue, because let me just tell you a rather interesting line of argument that was run in a Harvard Law Review a few years ago by Jack Greenspun or something. There are two important Supreme Court cases having to do with capital punishment. The biggie was in 1976. It was in Gregg versus Georgia. But 4 years prior to this, there was a case called Furman versus Georgia. And Furman was a death row inmate. And his attorneys argued, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. His attorneys argued that their client should not be electrocuted in Georgia because, in the attorney's view, all of the existing forms of capital punishment, hanging, firing squad, electrocution, gas chamber, all of them qualified as forms of cruel and unusual punishment forbidden by the Eighth Amendment, okay? And so it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the question put before the Baroque judges by the attorneys for Furman was this: true or false, are the existing modes of capital punishment instances of cruel and unusual punishment forbidden by the Eighth Amendment? That's the question that was launched. The court waffled. It didn't answer that question. What it came back with and said is that the way capital punishment was meted out in Georgia was unprincipled, capricious, arbitrary, ruleless, and in that sense, as practiced in Georgia, was cruel and unusual punishment. Now, I mean, they couldn't find any rhyme or reason where you get white guys that are convicted of first-degree murder and they get life imprisonment. You get black guys, the same kinds of circumstances, and fry them, you know, and so forth. And it looks like an exercise in prejudice, according to the court. So they simply say, you know, this seems like ruleless, arbitrary, capricious meeting it out, and in that sense, it's a violation of cruel and unusual punishment. Okay? Now, that's what the Supreme Court said in 1972. In 1976, they finally bit the bullet and said, no, it's not cruel and unusual punishment. But look, to get back to your point, maybe we should put a moratorium until we can clean up our litigation on that. What this guy predicts is that, I mean, if you read the articles coming out in law journals and magazines, we have not cleaned up our act litigationally since 1972. I mean, there is more evidence now than there ever has been that if you try and figure out what the variables are which determine whether somebody gets capital punishment for first-degree murder rather than some alternative sentence, it has more to do with the quality of attorneys you have representing you, which are usually rotten, than the issue of guilt or innocence. You know, I mean, that's what calls it. So what this guy ends up predicting is that some wise attorney, very shortly, is going to go before the Supreme Court and says, Your Honor, remember what you said back in 1972, that the way capital punishment was meted out in Georgia was cruel and unusual because it was haphazard and arbitrary? Some attorney is going to be able to convince the judges that nothing has changed and that the way capital punishment is meted out in most states is more capricious and arbitrary and racially discriminatory than it ever was, and the court's going to say, forget it, no more capital punishment. That's what's going to happen. It's a legal prediction.
Is that going to be based on the Constitution, on the Eighth?
It will be based on the interpretation they gave in 72 that the way it was meted out, not that the punishment itself was cruel and unusual, but the way it was distributed was arbitrary, capricious, and in that sense, cruel and unusual. I mean, that's the wager of this Harvard Law Review, right? Somebody's going to say, look, nothing has changed, Your Honors.
Does a criminal give up his constitutional rights? A convicted criminal? No?
Mm-hmm. Constitutional rights of what?
Of that particular felon, that conduct.
The application of the Eighth Amendment, for example. Do they give up the right to lean on the Constitution?
I
would say not, because that's the whole basis of continued litigation or appeals or whatever, to continue to try to properly apply the Constitution in whatever case it is.
The Constitution was constructed for the betterment of society,
right,
as a whole. What about these people, these convicts that attacked society?
But it's also for the individual, so they are protected against the whole, protected from the whole. Mm-hmm. That's just as important as protecting the whole from the individual.
Even though the person is without a doubt convicted?
Yeah.
Our questioner.
Let me think of the plot, just to follow up on this. Remember, one of the... I think that one of the premises hidden offstage premises that drives the retribution argument is the claim that if somebody has murdered another person, that they have forfeited their own right to life. Okay, and it's part of the package of the retribution argument. It lies in the wings, but you have to bring it on stage to examine it. Let's walk this path a little bit. I submit that when we extinguish a person's life, that this is a symbolic way of saying that they are worthless. Because we are permitted to take away everything they have by executing them. They have no residual moral dignity, they forfeited it all. And therefore it's okay to take away everything they have. Let me test this. Let's suppose we have a convicted murderer. Do you think that it would be all right to just never kill the guy, but just sort of slowly torture him more innovatively day after day? I mean, do you think that'd be okay?
Well, that's what you're doing when you're interning.
When you're what?
When they're convicted and they sit in prison.
And some people have said, talk about cruel and unusual punishment. If you want an equality between the punishment endured and the gravity of the crime against the victim, usually victims are wasted in about a matter of seconds or something. But then you have the pain endured by the death row prisoner, and we're just all out of whack with respect to equality. If anything, the prisoner's suffering more than the original. I don't know whether you like this argument, but somebody could run it this way. But look, if you back down and say, gee, even somebody who's murdered somebody, I don't think that it's okay to simply torture that individual. I would ask you, well, is it okay to make the person into a medical guinea pig? Just shoot them up with this and that, just see what the reactions are. I'm not so sure about that. Would it be okay to simply use them as a sexual object? You know, all kinds of aberrant behavior, because after all, it's worthless, isn't he? And I said, well, I'm not so sure about that. I want to say, now hold it here. Are you trying to tell me that he has a right not to be tortured, even though he's killed somebody? A right not to be made into a medical guinea pig? A right not to be made into a mere sex? Are you giving me this? Well, he's got some residual dignity? Well, this is rather interesting. You say, well, he's got a right not to be tortured, but it's okay for us to take away everything he has. I mean, is there some inconsistency? Peter, or Michael.
What do you think about the argument that you didn't bring up yet, that I see this promise argument against capital punishment, that the person might deserve the ultimate punishment if you think about Jeffrey Dahmer, for example, but I would argue against capital punishment because it is below the dignity of the state.
Yeah. The dignity of the state?
Of the state. To execute people. I think it's a barbarous state of mind that you think that is one of the roles that the state has. And if you look at the countries that have capital punishment and countries that abolish capital punishment, we feel more comfortable aligning ourselves with the states that have abolished capital punishment than the ones that haven't, like Iran or Sudan.
Now, is what's behind you here is that the state should be an example of proper behavior. And that if we abolish capital punishment, we would send a message that needs to be heard, namely that the cycle of vengeance must stop, and that vengeance and that violence is only justifiable in truly cases of self-defense. And you can't make the case that some murderer who is now behind bars and disarmed is a threat to society anymore. And if you go and waste them, you've crossed the line. It's a needless step, because one thought, all you're trying to do is protect society from him. And you've successfully done that. You don't need to kill him too.
Or another angle of that, it's easier for me to understand a crime of passion than cold, calculated, reasonable, rational state, a body of good thinkers to kill somebody, not murder somebody, but to put an end to life to somebody. And then there's always that nice little cute little stick, a button. Why do you kill people to show that killing people is wrong? Mm-hmm. You know.
How about walking a little further, just to plumb the depths of this? Well, let's take the 80% of murders, the lion's share of murders which are committed as crimes of passion. I would submit that a moment of a drug high, an alcohol high, a moment of jealousy, a moment of rage, is by definition an atypical moment in a likely individual. Atypical. And it wouldn't surprise me to think that that is sort of a wacko moment in a person's life. It doesn't represent the standard manner of behavior. It was sort of off the kilter. And I guess I would begin to suspect that I may not really have good reason to think that simply because somebody's murdered once that that it's likely they're going to do it again.
Unless it's the state.
Huh?
Unless it's the state.
But that's exactly what I argued about. Because here's the issue. One of the stunning facts which came up in a study that I've got a copy of here was, let's go back to that argument which says dead murderers don't murder again. So if we killed every murderer, we're not going to have any murders out of them. Well, one of the interesting things is, how much public protection are we really going to buy? I'm not worried about retribution anymore. How much public protection would we buy if we executed summarily every single murderer that had been convicted? How much protection? How would you get data on this? Well, one way to do it would be to simply say, well, what about states that don't have capital punishment and all they offer is life imprisonment? Now, how often do life imprisonment people convicted of murder again, either inside the prison or if on parole? And the startling fact of it is that less than 1% do.
But, there's just a case in Pennsylvania that cost Mark Singles the election of being governor, because he was on the board to pardon the convicted killer, and that killer killed again in the state of New York just a month before the election, and it came out that Mark Singles had pardoned him, and Governor Rich was running on a death penalty platform, and he won the election, because at the point, if this guy would not have been pardoned, the woman that he murdered in New York State would still be alive. So these cases happen, and then it's always much easier.
All this publicity, but it's not put in context of how often it happens among the total criminal population. We only got a few minutes left. I want to pick the brains of my theologian friends here. If you ask, well, what sorts of biblical texts are available for us to help think through what should be an appropriate state response to capital punishment? There's a couple that I know of. They're both in the New Testament. It seems to me that I've got problems. They seem to speak in different ways. You've got the story in John chapter 8, a woman that had committed adultery, and the people bring her to Jesus and said, you know, she's committed adultery. She was caught indeed in the very act. And the law says that she must be stoned, which was capital punishment of their day. And Jesus, after he finishes just drooling in the sand or something, says, Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. And of course they all go away. No one wants to cast the first stone, and then he looks up and a woman is still there and says, you know, how does the story go? And says, well,
where are
you? Is there no one here to condemn you? You know, I don't condemn you either. Now, one interpretation.
And then some people thought that was too easy, so they say that with later addition, go and sin no more.
Go and sin no more. Yeah, but can you build from this Jesus' own frowning upon capital punishment, or is the judgment that he's against all punishment? I mean, what is the correct inference? Let's just suppose that there you have some sort of a model which says, don't practice capital punishment.